Welcome to the Exceptional Sales Leader Podcast with Darren Mitchell. If you're a sales leader looking to take your leadership to a whole new level, then this is the podcast for you. We'll be exploring tips, techniques, and strategies to help you take your leadership to the exceptional level and allow you to enjoy more money, more meaning, and better sales results. Welcome back to the Exceptional Sales Leader Podcast, and a very special welcome coming all the way from Sydney in an office, which hanging behind her is, I'm not sure whether it's a banana or a pineapple or some sort of combination. Welcome to the podcast, Abby White, founder and CEO of Sales Redefined. Welcome.
Thank you for having me. And I have to defend myself. I'm in the city today out of a WeWork office, and I came in and looked at the background. I was like, I'm not sure that's the best background for a podcast, but I'm going to work with what we've got. And I guess that's what us sales folks are all about. So yeah, I don't know whether it's a pineapple or a banana. It's both.
It's weird, isn't it? But I'm sure it's a definition of art in some form. Well, thankfully, most people who are going to be listening to this will be just listening to the audio. But if you are listening to this and you're a visual type learner, think about a banana with some what looks like some spurs or little prongs off them, and a pineapple. What's a pineapple? Is it a pineapple frond? Is that how you describe it? The top of a pineapple or the leaf?
It definitely looks like the top is from a pineapple for sure. Yeah. It's a combo.
Absolutely. Now, people listening to this in the first 30 seconds to a minute, I'm thinking, well, I'm not listening to this just based on bloody pineapples and bananas. So we're not here to talk about that. We are here to talk about sales and sales leadership. So I'm very much looking forward to this conversation, Abby. You have a long and distinguished career in sales and sales leadership, having worked with some of the biggest organizations the world has ever known. But today you're working in an organization as a founder and CEO of Sales Redefined, which it's going to be a great conversation because there's lots of different topics we want to talk about today. As a first foundational conversation starter, just a little bit about your background, and I'd love to know what got you into sales in the first place, but what's led you to do what you do today? Was there sort of some sort of catalytic moment that created the platform? So I'd love to start with that.
Yeah, so I fell into sales, which I think most people did. I don't know many people at school or uni go, yeah, I want to go into sales. I was really fortunate. I did an internship as part of my degree at IBM. And it was in sales operations, and everyone said, oh, you'd be great in sales. And I said, no, because I was like, oh, is it because I'm loud? Is it because I like talking? Why do you think I'd be great in sales? And I just had this perception in my head of, you know, used car salesman. I was like, nah, not doing it. And I was really fortunate that I shadowed all these phenomenal salespeople and really saw what it was all about, loved being client-facing, loved being on the road, loved being out and about, and just loved everything about that. And so I then went, yep, okay, I'm going to do it. So I went on to the graduate program with IBM and went through their sales school process, which is a massive two-year process, huge amounts of enablement, huge amounts of shadowing, and really, really fantastic program. Long story short, sort of climbed the ladder through IBM, moved to Australia. They needed someone to come from the UK to Australia to run the national sales team for one of the hardware divisions. And, you know, team player that I am, I was like, yep, I'm there. Australia, beaches. That's all I was thinking. So ran a national sales team for $100 million business unit for IBM. And then that part of the business got sold off as part of a divestiture. And I went with it for a really short period of time. And that kind of probably gave me the impetus to go, what do I want to do? And really then looked at leaving world of corporate and starting Sales Redefined. And the sort of name came from, as it kind of says on the tin, I was always really frustrated with that used car salesman analogy. And it's just like so many, you know, I was on holiday once and someone said to me, what do you do for a living? And I said, I'm in sales, which I'm really proud of. And they were like, oh, so, you know, you rip people off for a living. I was like, oh, and I just feel like there is such a misunderstanding. And I was like, nah, I want to be redefining it. And I also think we need to constantly redefine sales, particularly at the moment. You know, we are doing a huge amount of work trying to keep up with the pace of change. So that's sort of really what started me on my journey towards Sales Redefined. And then now today we're working with huge amount of businesses. We've got quite a lot in the IT sector because that's sort of my background and some of the team's background. But we've also become known a bit as the marriage counselor between sales and marketing, because on that journey of helping people, how do you grow your sales? How do you, deliver that growth? We started seeing a bit of a disconnect between different teams, and particularly sales and marketing. And so to get the outcome, to get the results, get the growth, we had to really start repairing that relationship. So that sort of brings us full circle to today. And then Sales Redefined's been going for 7 years. And I think sort of final point on that, I think that's where you really learn how to sell. You know, when you've got IBM behind you, that's one hell of a weapon. Whether you love them or hate them, you've probably heard of them. But you'd know the name, right? You'd know the brand, and I'm sure as you would relate to when you start your own business, you're really out there on your own, starting from zero.
It's funny because I worked in telecommunications and ICT, so I was at Optus and then Telstra, and through that experience, both organizations were going through, I guess, a transition around taking on more IT type work, doing a lot more managed services and looking at systems integration and stuff like that. And a lot of the rhetoric within the industry was, you know what, IBM is such a big behemoth, but there's not a single person at that time, and maybe it's changed now, but not a single CIO or, chief revenue officer, not that I'll call that back in the day, had ever been sacked for dealing with IBM. So it was almost like, well, I'm Abby from IBM, and it would kind of open doors that others may not have had that opportunity to have doors open for. And we kind of found that the same with Telstra and to a lesser extent Optus. But a lot of the smaller integrators and a lot of the smaller organizations didn't have that power. So they had to do things differently. And certainly starting your own business, all of a sudden you've gone from a big behemoth like that to either Sales Redefined or, what I do. And it's like, yeah, who? But it does point to the fact that, you know what, we do have a reputation, whether we like it or not. Hopefully that reputation is a good one. And it just takes work, right? Because you don't have that big behemoth of an organization behind you to open up that door. So you've got
Yeah,
to
totally
come
agree.
into it. So there's a number of things I'd love to explore. One of the things you mentioned sales as being similar to dodgy car salespeople, and what's your current perception of sales out there? Because I've got certain views around sales, and I certainly don't ever excuse myself for being in sales, because I think it's one of the greatest and most fulfilling careers on the planet. How do you think the perception of sales is out there right now, particularly in the industries that you're working in?
I think the perception still needs work. I mean, if you look at the latest research on who is trusted, salespeople, the sales profession is still not considered trusted. No real great surprises there. So I still think it needs work. I think it's getting better. And I think that sometimes we don't help ourselves. I was listening to your podcast with Amy around LinkedIn. And by the way, for anyone listening, I thought that was a great episode to revisit. And I really kind of liked what Amy was talking about, where she shared, on LinkedIn, people are going straight in for the kill, straight in of, I view it as getting married on the first date, and literally you're like, hi, buy my product or service. And so we kind of don't help ourselves when we behave and we act like that. And so I think that I really liked Amy's point, and I completely agree that actually it gives us an opportunity to stand out, because when you are the person, I look at it as, don't be the best friend that turns up when you want something. You all know the person you see ringing on your phone, you're like, what do they want? And I don't want to be that person. And I come from a school of thought. There's a lady called Julie Masters, who I do a lot of work with, who specialize in influence. And she talks about, how do you out contribute in the industry? You can outshout, you can outspend, or you can out contribute. And I really like that. And I love the opportunity it gives, and agree with Amy's point on this, because I don't believe many people are doing it well. And so therefore it gives us a great opportunity. And I think in a way we've got no excuse now. There's so much research data out there, substantial, to show what high performance salespeople are doing well and differently to the rest of the pack. So we don't really have an excuse not to elevate. What's your th I'm curious on your thoughts there.
Well, and I love the comment you made around out contribute, because I come from a servitude perspective, and I say, certainly when I work with leaders, it's all about the giving and the serving. It's not with any expectation of anything in return, right? So in a sales capacity, you've got to be looking at what are the problems out there that need to be solved, and how can I identify companies and organizations and people who have problems that they want to have solved or they need to have solved and prepared to do something with it. It's often salespeople having to make excuses or justification for the role they have, and they've got to make revenue, and they're under all sorts of pressure internally, which we get. But it's always I always use sales in what I'm talking about is it's the ultimate form of service. And so if you can have a problem that's been identified and you happen to have a solution to that problem, and if you can lead with service, not with what can I get from that particular organization, then many times that organization or that person will lean in and be curious in terms of, do you have a solution? Now, when that happens, a natural consequence, more times than not, will be there'll be some form of transaction either in the short term, midterm, or long term. But it's not here to, I'm not here to convince you that my product's the best product. And I'm certainly not here to try to push onto you the something you don't want. And I think that's where a lot of the reputation that sales has, and it goes historically, is mandated or founded in that dodgy salesperson. Because whenever you have, and I'd be interested in your take on this as well, how many roles now have sales removed from the title, but at their core, they are actually sales roles, customer success manager, account directors, all that sort of stuff. They are target-driven, revenue-driven, sales-driven roles, but they don't have sales in the title. So it's all about service for me. And if you can lead with service, then a natural consequence will be you'll do a transaction. The other part I'll add, just as because it's this is about you, not me, even though it's my podcast, is that the sale actually doesn't start until after the sale is made. So you talk about being in the game and building credibility and being there not when there's something for you to get, but just being there and serving is. There are so many organizations that have a salesperson all over them until the transaction's done, and then they don't see them in again because they've moved on to the next customer. The test will be, are they going to hang around?
Yeah, I love that. And actually, if I can share a quick story on that, I worked ages ago with a nutritionist, and which was an interesting field for me. And she had this membership. She was getting fantastic outcomes for people. She had people who were struggling with diabetes, and they weren't able to play with their kids and have the energy they wanted, or having health issues that were impacting their quality of life, and so on. You get the picture. And she had no one really on the membership, and she said, "Look, I'm a healthcare professional. I'm trusted. I don't want to ever be seen as salesy." And I reframed it, and long story short, I said, "Right, talk to me just purely about the outcomes you get for people. If I was part of this membership program, what would I do? I'm that person with diabetes. What are the outcomes?" And I said, "Give me a story of someone you've worked with that you just had the best outcome, and you were like, 'God, if I could do that all day, every day, that's me.'" And I got her to write up on a piece of paper and put it up there of her outcome, of her favorite client success story. I said, "Every time you don't want to have the conversation, you don't want to pick up the phone, you don't want to do all the different tasks associated with an activity associated with sales, I want you to look at that testimony. I want you to look at that story and go, 'How do I deliver that outcome for more people?' And if I don't even have a conversation, I don't even share some of my knowledge and wisdom, I don't even start having that, then I'm denying people the opportunity to get that result." So off she went and she started doing it. And then 2 weeks later, she sold out her membership and came back to me. No Facebook ads, no, thousands of dollars on lead gen. It was purely actually mindset towards sales and reframing it away from being the used car salesman and salesy back to actually, if I don't share, if I don't contribute, if I don't do this, I'm denying people an opportunity.
That's it, which is a great definition and example of serving, right? Because it's a definitive health benefit and a lifestyle benefit to that particular customer that they'd be doing them a disservice if they didn't provide them the opportunity. It's a solution to a problem. Now, is that solution going to be the I guess the solution for every single person's problem? No. And this is, I think, the challenge with a lot of sales teams is they think, well, our product is so good, we can retrofit our product into any situation. So you've got sales teams that are going out there trying to throw as much mud up against the wall as they possibly can, hoping that some of it's going to stick. But it's the organizations that can do it a lot more strategically who understand, hey, the product I have, the solution I have is not for everybody. My job is to find out who deserves to get access to this, who qualifies for access to this, not who can I send this to? Who can I give it to? Right? Completely different mindset. So you're absolutely spot on. Which kind of piques a little bit of interest for me. And having spent so much time at IBM, I'd be really curious to know from you, how was IBM's, and this is not about IBM specifically, but it's just an example. How focused were IBM on their solutions and I guess the fixation, for want of a better term, on how good those solutions were, whether it be market leading or not, which then led to, I guess, the sales teams and everybody associated with revenue generation almost going, hey, we have the best solution. So it almost like, why wouldn't you do business with us? So I guess the question is, how much of that was, do you think, product and service led in terms of sales campaign versus customer problem led?
Yeah, look, it's a brilliant question. I think it's a brilliant question for the IT industry, actually, because I think as an industry, we've always been known for being very product and speeds and feeds and like, yeah, mine's bigger and better and faster. I will say that IBM, they have a fantastic sales training program. They really do. You know, it's not just a one-hit wonder and we do it once and great, tick in the box. You know, I was on a 2-year sales school, then I was on a top talent program. So I would say they were very good at investing in people in the right sort of development. And I think the time when I came into sales in IBM, we were definitely on that journey of solution selling. You know, IBM's not known for being the cheapest, right? So you're not going to be the vendor that's there selling just purely on price and like, let me give you a discount. So I think you were then encouraged and had to learn how to go through that solution selling period. I would say I was part of that sort of generation and phase. But I think we were also very, very good at being taught how to focus on the outcome. And I think that's such a huge thing. I actually recently had a client of mine who was my client at IBM and like, 15 odd years on, he was out in Australia, and I got him to come and speak on a panel where I was doing a sales kickoff for an IT vendor. And I was like, I know the guy, and he was a global CIO. And I got him to come and speak. And he said, the reason why people can't get their IT business cases over the line is because they're just focusing on the products, the speeds, the feeds. You've got to be able to go in there and go, right, here's the outcome. Do we all agree as a business, this is where we need to go? This is what we need to be doing. These are the business outcomes that we need to be delivering. Yes. Okay, well, if you agree that, then here's the things we've got to do, and these are the products, and this is the roadmap. And it was a brilliant conversation because I think that, you know, a huge proportion of our client base is in IT still. And I think that we can all be guilty of that one. And we all probably need that reminder every now and again to continue having more what, like, I love looking at people's annual reports and seeing what are they committed to the shareholders and stakeholders. You know, what are the business problems that they're trying to solve? And then how do you have that as your sort of guiding star to keep you on point?
It's as you're talking there, I'm thinking to myself, hey, particularly in IT, a lot of organizations need to realize that your customers are not actually interested in your product. So why are we trying to flog the product all the time? It's a really interesting dynamic, isn't it?
Yeah, look, and we, you know, for the side of our business that we will do lead generation campaigns and we'll work with marketing teams and sales teams, if someone comes to us with a campaign and it's just very, very product, we actually won't do it. Because from what I have seen, in my experience, I don't believe I can deliver a result. And I'm a results kind of girl, you know, IBM, that's the one thing you do learn really strongly is, you know, no one gives you a high five for getting a like on LinkedIn. You get a high five when you hit your number and you get the results. So that's kind of my background. And so we actually won't do product campaigns for the types of clients that we work with in the types of industries that we're in this B2B space, because I've not seen a strong outcome or result from them. Now, don't get me wrong, there's certain technical people who love the products and love the speeds and feeds, and there's an appropriate place and time for that. But I wouldn't, as a pure cold lead generation campaign, kickstart and lead with that conversation.
Because that then leads into, I guess, how the buyer profile has changed over time. So if you think about, back in the day when we were carrying bags, you'd probably walk into a CIO's office and they'd almost be expecting you to ask them questions about their business and how it's all going. And that's where the knowledge was sort of sitting. It was within that organization. And similarly for us as, I guess, suppliers, the information that would be readily available would be coming through us as the salesperson. So, but today there is so much research that customers are doing, and they probably know more about you and your organization than sometimes we know about ourselves. There's just so much information. So how does that then fit in, particularly when it comes to the way that sales has changed? And we'll talk about high-performing sales habits today as well. How has that changed in terms of, I guess, companies' approaches to selling, given that their customers now are so much better educated and almost doing their decision-making processes before any interaction starts?
I 100% agree with you. I think the latest stats I read was people are 53% of the way through their decision-making process before they've even met with you. Like you said, they've researched, they've done their homework, they've narrowed and shortlisted who they want to talk to, and they probably are pretty well educated by then. The latest research that I read on this that I found really interesting was buyers still feel like sellers have not done their homework to un understand my business, understand my industry. And therefore understand my problems before you come in and have a conversation so we can have the right conversation. So I think as a sales profession, we really need to own it and step up a gear. And I think that comes back to, you know, if you look at the highest performing sellers and what are they doing, there's a fantastic piece of research that you've probably seen that LinkedIn just released with IPOS, where they looked at 2,000 sellers and they looked at 104 different behaviors. And they narrowed it down to just three habits. And if you do these three habits, you are two times more likely to exceed quota. If you don't do any of these habits, you are six times more likely to miss quota. Now, when you look at those habits, it's down to actually have you researched the customer and really understood and personalized? Have you reached out with timely, relevant conversation? Have you looked at, okay, well, if we're going to speak to this customer, have I looked for warm paths, warm connections, warm intros, and so on? And it's kind of fundamentals, really. It's not shocking, but it actually for me brings me back to, I think we have a challenge in sales that is, why do we not do what we know we should do? No one listening is probably shocked by what I just said, but it's probably that you just learned it when, in my instance, when you go through sales school and then you get into bad habits and you get a little bit, you know, lazy. I look at it like when you learn to drive a car, you know, you learn to drive with the two hands on the steering wheel and so on. And, you know, now I drive with one hand while screaming at my son in the background. You know, you get into bad habits. And I think we're the same in sales. And I think that's one of the challenges of going, how can we actually be disciplined enough to rebuild some of those foundations and go back to, okay, how can I research that customer so then when I walk in and the industry, so when I walk in, that buyer absolutely feels like, you get me, you get my world, you've worked with people like me. And I think it's going back to the fundamentals. Your
And the
thoughts there?
well, it's 100%. I 100% agree. And I was talking to a lady yesterday on the podcast, Anna Glynn, and she was, we were talking about the fact that there's a lot of positive psychology out there, and the fundamentals still work. And it's science. And she mentioned it's science, but it's not rocket science. And the fundamentals still work. But I think part of it may be the internal pressure that's placed on sales teams and sales individuals to hit quota, and particularly if you're behind quota. Instead of actually the sales leader coming in and rolling up the sleeves and thinking about how can we create a better environment to give ourselves the opportunity to serve these particular customers, it's all about what's your gap closure strategy. You need to have this sale in by this month or this, because otherwise we've got to report up to the CEO, who's got to report to the board, who's got to report to the market. So it's pressure, 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 number, number, number. And I think through that process, a lot of the fundamentals are missed. And if we understand one thing, and sales is not an instant gratification game, and statistically we know that around 2 to 3% of buyers are in a purchase now sort of cycle, which means 97 to 98% of the people we're talking to are not ready yet, and yet salespeople going in thinking that they'll just wow them with all the bits and bytes and the biggest networks and all that sort of stuff, and they wonder why they walk away with nothing. Well, you've got to invest, just like you build trust with teams, you've got to earn the right to sell to your customers, right? And you do that by doing the fundamentals, knowing more about them than perhaps they think you might know. So it's an interesting one, but I still get the fact that, hey, at the end of the day, the scoreboard tells us whether we're successful or not, and we have to sell, we have to hit numbers, and we've got to do that. Well, that's all that sort of stuff, but it's how we go about doing it. I love Simon Sinek's book, The Infinite Game, where he talks about, you know, it's you've still got the short-term challenges, and we've still got to hit numbers, but thinking about the longer-term strategy and the longer-term play. And back when I was running sales teams, I always found it quite humorous. And I didn't find it humorous in front of my senior leaders, but I'm sitting there thinking, okay, we've got pressure to hit this number by the 30th of June, and I get that, right? But the same customer is still going to be our customer on the 1st of July, and are probably looking at a longer term relationship. Why do we have to actually try to move heaven and earth to get everything in just to placate a number on a spreadsheet? It doesn't sit well with me. Anyway, end of
Yeah, look,
rant.
I definitely come from that background, with corporate, and a lot of my clients are in that scenario where, it is the end of quarter, the end of month. It's absolutely, that's it, and the pricing that's on the table is only for that month. So I do get that, and it can lead to it can be a good thing and a bad thing. It can have a bit of scarcity, which we sometimes need, but it can also lead to bad behaviors. My favorite answer to all of this is I love the Dream 100 approach, which I'm sure you're across, but for anyone listening who hasn't come across it, Chet Holmes talks about it in The Ultimate Sales Machine, the book, and it was Warren Buffett's business partner, Charlie Munger, who came up with the Dream 100. And he looked at, okay, stop scattergun prospecting and approach to sales, and stop taking the short-term view, like you said, like, crap, I'm not going to hit my number this month, let's go. Who would be my Dream 100 clients? What is the, who are the 20% of people who have 80% of the spend in the market? And Charlie Munger was trying to target the media industry, and he was just scattergun. He was the underdog, and he wasn't getting anywhere. So we went, okay, cool. Who are the 20% of people who have 80% of the spend? Wrote them all down in a Dream 100. How can I continue turning up, adding value, turning up, adding value, turning up, adding value, turning up, turning up, turning up, until people probably were at the point of like, okay, I'm just going to meet with this guy just to work out what the hell he's going on about. But he was consistent, and after 3 months, he kind of hadn't really got anywhere. But after 4 or 5 months, he'd started, to your point, only 3% of people are ready to buy now. He started to get some of those conversations going. Within a year, he had the monopoly and he had the majority of the market. But he had the discipline to play the long-term game. He was always prospecting as well. So it wasn't like, oh, I've just got a new quota, I need to prospect now. He always had his foot on the gas. There was always petrol going into the car. So he was never in that sort of situation, and then that really paid off. But I think that's quite a strategic approach. Now I get that, depending on, for people screaming at me right now, depending on your territory, your quota, your number, we've got some clients who are on 100% commission only. I totally get some of what I'm saying might be easier than done, but I still think there's ways that all of us, I apply it to my business, I practice what I preach. I still think there's ways all of us can do that, and I think it leads to the right behaviors. Because if you've got a Dream 100, you've got to research them. You've got to profile them. You've got to take a strategic approach. You've got to continue showing up, adding value. You've got to play the long-term game. So it kind of almost forces me to into the right behaviors. So that's a strategy I love.
And you said a really important thing there, and it's a long-term game. So, and it kind of rings home true the thing that I've been talking about all the time, and that sale doesn't start until after the sale is made. And maybe the first sale is not actually a transaction. It may well be a conversation. It may well be a piece of content that you share with a prospective customer that might add value to them because it's something you've seen that's happening in the industry that might start to create a little bit of differentiation between you and everybody else that's trying to get their attention. So it doesn't necessarily have to be a sale, but you've got to stay in the game. And the other word you used there was consistency. You've got to consistently stay in the game and continue to put yourself out there.
Yeah, totally agree.
And so with that, let's talk about I guess high performance selling. And you touched on some three key habits there, which we've always said is not rocket science, but in 2024 and beyond, and particularly with the advent of things like AI and how AI potentially is going to supercharge the ability to do messaging and proposals and all that sort of stuff, and hopefully will never replace salespeople. What are some key high performance sales, either not so much metrics but capabilities, characteristics that I think if we hang on to, we can give ourselves every opportunity of really creating value in the marketplace.
Yeah, so I'm potentially a little bit different on this one. It's like when I read and when I learn, I don't often read sales books, which really surprises people. I want to read all different walks of life and bring it back into sales. And we recently did a piece of work as a team going, okay, what do we think the skills people need to develop are now to be successful in 2024. And it was completely different to what we came up with 12 months ago. So as you rightly said, we had AI on the list. You know, whatever your views are on AI, it's here. That research I mentioned by LinkedIn of 2,000 sellers that only came out a few weeks ago, they found that 75% of people exceeding quota were leveraging AI. So I think there's starting to be enough proof in the pudding, but I think that you have to learn. We had an external person come into our business to teach us how to use different AI tools. And we established that all of my team, just in case we sound like we're really good and know what we're doing, all of us were using it differently. Some of us were using it incorrectly and not efficiently. And so we had to invest in that as enablement. The other one that I'm really passionate about at the moment is I think there's a skill that we need to develop in sales that you historically would have thought about more as marketing, which is around how do you hook attention and how do you then drive that attention into engagement and so on. And what I mean by that is, you know, if we now apparently have a 7 or 8 second attention span as humans, and you think about how in the morning you sit at your desk, how do you filter your inbox and just go delete, 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 delete? How do you filter that LinkedIn message? I typically read the first three words and then I delete. I think the game now is how in the first couple lines of when I talk to you, the first couple lines of my email, the first couple lines of my LinkedIn message, how am I sounding different to everybody else, like Amy talked about on your episode, but how do I also hook your attention and stand out? And we've had recently we've been getting Maz Farrelly in, who she wrote The X Factor, she wrote Farmer Wants a Wife, she wrote Celebrity Apprentice. Her content has had 8 billion views. She sold a multi-million dollar TV show over an email. She just thinks about what is it my audience want? How do I interest them? And her famous line that she talks about is, it's not my job to be interested in you, it's your job to be interesting. And she just completely, and she's brutal when she delivers it.
So just hold that thought. She said, my job is not to be interested in you. Your job is to be interesting.
Yeah. And I'll give you a really good example that she uses. She's this like really feisty British woman who's just, I love her more than life itself. She is fantastic. And people can sit there and go, oh, I don't like The X Factor. I don't like reality TV. She got more people to vote in Britain's Got Talent than the general election. And I'm not proud of that as a Brit. But she knows how to hook attention. And so she uses her skills as a TV producer to now work with businesses. And so she's worked with my team around disruptive thinking, around hooking attention. She's worked with our members and some of our clients. And so if you think about something like that, that skill set around how do I hook attention, be it on my proposal, my presentation, my LinkedIn post, my prospect email, whatever it is, I don't believe, and in my career, and maybe you've had otherwise, but I haven't in my career, I've never done a lesson on that. And I think that now some of the skills and some of the people that we should be learning from, I think we should be learning from people like that. Like I learn something from her every time I listen to her. And I think that's where as sales, it's now not just going, well, do I know how to negotiate? Do I know how to prospect? I think those sorts of skill sets, I think make us so much more rounded, because I tell you what, every email message, everything I send now, geez, do I think about it 10 times more before I send it?
It's funny you say that, because there's so many organizations and people out there fighting for your attention, isn't there? So it's logical that you've got to think about, well, how is it that you're going to open my email against somebody else? Now, just the really simple thing yesterday, and I haven't used this, but I've started to now from yesterday, is in messaging, and I didn't do this with you last night when we're on LinkedIn, but using the voice memos on LinkedIn as a message, a thank you message or a reach out message, whatever the case might be. Some of the people I was talking with said they've been using that for the last couple of months and their response rates have gone through the roof because it's different. Now, that's a great example, will be a really simple example about not so much what you're saying to grab people's attention, but the fact that somebody's sending you a personalized voice message through a platform like LinkedIn all of a sudden says, well, this is different. Because most other people are just sending me an email or a message, right? Which just fills up the inbox like it does with email. So really different, really different. So any key ideas then or tips, not so much what to say, but, you know, a person listening to this thinking, well, okay, I'm not an IBM. I'm maybe a second or third tier, respectfully, player in the marketplace, and I'm just trying to grapple with all the competitors and how do I differentiate myself? Any key thoughts based on your research and based on your experience in terms of what that hook could be?
Yeah, look, I think if you're a second or third tier organization, which a lot of our clients are as well, I actually think you've got the advantage because you don't have the same global brand guidelines, global sort of restrictions, global parameters where perhaps all your marketing is coming out of a certain country in the world, and you are bound by that. I think you have more flexibility to be nimble. So I actually think that's an advantage. That's why I love being at Sales Redefined now, because I can play. I can do that, professionally, but you can. In terms of that, we, after working with Maz, we implemented what we called the Maz boring test. And now, whether it's for ourselves or whether we're producing it for a client, we go, right, is this white noise? So we do what Maz taught us around how would you filter a TV script. Maz looks at it as if you've got a Netflix ad that's a trailer for your TV show, you've got 60 seconds less than, because you'll switch off after about five, to hook and grab someone's attention. So what is your hook? There's a fantastic book called Brendan Kane called Hook Point that talks about this. So what Maz does is think about, right, anything that if someone sends something to me and it starts with, now more than ever before, in unprecedented times, I literally go, nah, can't handle it, and delete. And I'll give you a really good example. We were recently working with a managed service provider, and they gave us their messaging and gave us what they perceived were their uniques. And we said, who are the two people you're competing against? We got all three next to each other, and we put them next to each other. And they were all, we've been in business for 25 years. We're local to the market. We're customer centric. And that's not being me being rude, right? Because it's really hard to differentiate, and it's really hard to stand out. But they all read, looked, and sounded exactly the same. And if you come at this from more of a neuroscience perspective, our brain is trained to spot the pattern, sorry. And you have to think about pattern disruption and going, because we are getting thousands and thousands of bits of information every single day, you have to have the thing that makes me go, oh, okay. And hooks my attention enough to stand out, because it doesn't look, feel, sound like everyone else. So I think I like looking at it, and if it starts with, I've been in business for 15 years, or I've been doing this for whatever, and trust me, I was the first person to log on to my LinkedIn profile and go, oh my gosh, I need to change that. And I'm not pretending that it's perfect. But that for me has kind of filtered the process to just go, how do we stand out? And I also think it's back to some of your earlier points around serving, of going, the most client-centric and customer-centric wins. We will always send a sales team a survey to go, what are the hottest topics your clients are talking about right now? What are the biggest challenges they're talking about? And we spot the pattern and spot the theme. If we then lean into that and run a campaign based on that, then oh my goodness, it is magic. And we've had 2,000% ROIs. We've had campaigns that have gone global, translated into multiple languages, not because we're a rocket scientist, but because we leaned into it. We didn't talk, to your point, exactly. We didn't talk about the product. We leaned into what does the customer want. So I think what I've learned through Maz has been more treating myself like a TV producer and filtering white noise and trying to really sound different by. The game I want to play is I want to be most in tune with the customer.
And if I could summarize all of that, I would say understand that irrespective of how good you are as an individual or how good you are as a company, it's not about you. And your customer's not interested in that. They couldn't give a rat's ass with, excuse the French, how many years you've been in business or how big your reach is or how many customers you've got. What they want to know is, can you solve my problem? And if we lean in based on what you've just been talking about, if we have information that we know is going to resonate with that customer because we're talking a language that they get, all of a sudden they think, wow, there's some familiarity here. So I'm more likely to now lean into whatever you might have to say. But it's not about the product, it's not about the service, it's about, do you get me?
Yeah, and like we had a conversation at the start of this where you said you'd noticed on my LinkedIn that I had marriage counselor for sales and marketing. Now I do that really deliberately because I could have, sales expert, I've done X amount of millions in sales and blah, blah, blah. And trust me, I do have part of that, so guilty. But I also have marriage, before I pretend I'm innocent, I do have marriage counselor for sales and marketing. Now you might think that's rubbish and that's fine, but you're probably gonna go, what is that? What does that mean? And like you did, ask a question. And that to me then kickstarts a conversation. And so I think like, and you're going to remember it, right? And now if anyone says, oh, I've got a real challenge between the alignment between my sales and marketing, I would argue without trying to sound arrogant that most people would think of me because I'm really known for talking about that and so on. And so again, if I just had a very vanilla LinkedIn or a vanilla sort of spin on it, then it's really hard to remember and stand out. So I think that ability to hook attention, I think for all of us now is really key. And it's something I'm personally working on a lot because I think it's going to, our attention spans are dropping, noise is increasing. And so therefore, that's absolutely what it's become about.
Oh, absolutely. And if you think about customers, and this is what I talked with Amy about last week on LinkedIn. If you go to that as a, I guess as a shopfront window, you've only got about 7 seconds to grab that person's attention before they'll actually leave, unless there's something of interest to them. And to them, it's not going to be about how many, with respect, how many deals you've done and how big your network is, whatever. It's, do you have a solution to a possible problem that I have, and are you speaking the language that I get? So, which then leads to, okay, we've got the hooking part, and you mentioned the marriage counselor part, so I can't leave this podcast without delving into this a little bit. I was doing a podcast with a UK organization a couple of months ago, and we were talking about sales enablement, and it was interviewing me about my take on this. I have certain views around what sales and marketing should be doing. Unfortunately, still today, in my experience, a lot of organizations still have them completely separate. What's your take on how closely aligned sales and marketing should be? And I know we've got sales enablement, we've got revenue enablement, we've got marketing, lead generation, and maybe even post sales. So just talk me through, I guess, the marriage counselor part in terms of the approach that, not so much that you're seeing in the marketplace, but based on the experience you've had working with organizations who you've helped align. What results can organizations get when we have closer alignment between sales and marketing?
I think this is probably the number one missed opportunity that I see in most organizations. If you want to look at it from a research perspective, because I love my stats, 9 out of 10 sales and marketing professionals do not feel they're aligned on strategy, KPI, culture. Hopefully I can say this, but there's the old age view that marketing are just the coloring in and sales are just at the pub, right? And so there's a cultural misalignment as well. Sales are lazy, all those sorts of things. And I think it is the biggest leaky funnel. So to give you an example, when we start working with someone, the first thing I'll say is, I'll say to sales, where are you winning? Where are you seeing success? What's working? What are you hearing right now? And same thing, I'll say to marketing. And we 9 times out of 10, I'll go as far as that, we'll get a brief from marketing saying, right, we would like to run a campaign on the education sector. And we go, fantastic. Can we talk to sales as well? Because we want both lenses. I'm not saying one's better than the other. I want both lenses. And we'll say to sales, what do you think to education? And they go, oh God, load of rubbish. We're not even on the panel. We can't even, we don't even get paid. So absolutely rubbish. Or we've had ones recently where marketing say, I had one recently where I wanted to cry. Someone had spent $100,000 on a campaign and got zero results. And they came to us and said, why do you think that is? And we looked at it for about 5 minutes and went, yeah, can see why it is. We spoke to sales and said, do you feel confident having this conversation and do you get paid on it? To which 93% of their sales team said they don't feel confident having that conversation. And so if they're not confident having the conversation, they're not going to follow up on the leads. They're not going to nurture it. They're not going to. They're not paid on it and it's not worth getting out of bed for. They're not going to be excited about it. So this misalignment, it gets better. LinkedIn actually did a study of how marketing are using LinkedIn and how sales are using LinkedIn. Over 75% of the time, they're targeting different audiences, not even talking to the same people. And so that's where this joke has come from amongst our client base, that we're the marriage counselor between sales and marketing, because we're going, you're spending all this money on whatever marketing campaign it might be, and your conversion is minimal because of the fact that either no one's following it up. So that's the other classic, 50% of salespeople don't follow up marketing leads. 70% of what marketing produce, sales never use. So there's this divorced couple, and I don't mean like a Gwyneth Paltrow happily divorced, conscious uncoupling kind. It's the ugly divorced kind. And it's the biggest source for me of missed opportunity. And I think my final point on it, and sorry, this is my hot topic, is I don't think you can allow that to happen anymore, because we're in the age now of digital sales. Love it, hate it, whatever your opinion is, it's a fact that digital sales is coming in thick and fast, and that we now have to have an end-to-end seamless customer journey. And even if you think about digital sales and you go, whose responsibility is that? Is that sales or is that marketing or is it not? It's a really blurry line. And so for me, you have to think, you know, I love the word smarketing, that initially I think HubSpot coined it, and then there's a few other people who really got behind it. And I love that word because I think that it is, you've got to have that seamless integration. And then, you know, the final part of your question, the results we've seen have been astronomical. We've had people do seven figures plus on a sales funnel. We've had massive, massive 2000% ROI results when you can bridge the gap. I can guarantee you it will fail if any of those parts don't stack up. You are wasting your time, your budget, your money. And so I think bringing the alignment between your revenue generating teams, 100%, I think that now has to be essential to growth, because in the digital age, you can't have them separate. That's my take, but I'm curious to get your take because you also seem to have strong views on this one.
And you've summarized it extremely well. I didn't say that as eloquently on the podcast that I was on as you just articulated, but I'm the same, right? You've got to have them on the same page, because there's too many organizations that point the finger. Marketing provide all this fantastic research, hand it over to sales. Sales say those leads are shit, but it's got nothing to do with the leads. It's the fact that we're not talking to the same person. Or we haven't got together in the first place and fully understood what is the problem we're trying to solve in the marketplace. Once that's aligned, then we can be on the same page and go to the marketplace with the same message. The other part that I'll throw in there as well is maybe what we need to do is look at how do we incentivize and how do we measure marketing and sales, because they're not necessarily remunerated in the same way. So I'm fully across or believing that maybe we need to have some sort of at-risk component, that we've got skin in the game, we're all aligned to the same purpose, trying to drive the same outcome. So yes.
Yeah, and I think there's a big part of that. The KPIs are not aligned. And so therefore it creates the disconnect. I also think how we have had, I cannot tell you how many times we've got sales and marketing in the room and they've gone, this is the first time we've done this. And organizations that you would not expect that to be the case. And this for me is, even if you're listening and you're like three or four people in a team, or you're a massive behemoth, I think it's the same problem, it's just on a different scale. And so I even think for my business, you know, we're a small team, we're a small business. When my team are going, right, we're going to do our content calendar, our social media, I'm going, cool, how is that marketing? And how is that customer centric? How is it all the rest of it? And how does it create a pathway that takes people on a journey towards sales? And so I think thinking like that is for small businesses and large. And we've seen a massive success with bringing marketing into sales kickoffs. And the aha moments, it's almost beautiful to watch the aha moments that people get, because when they're sitting working with the sales team doing some of the activities, and we're doing an activity around, you know, what you're seeing at the moment, or what clients are talking about right now, or what problems we've got right now, the aha moments of the two collaborating, it's just pure gold. So I think there's massive benefit right now if you have any shape or form of silo. 100%, the opportunity is break down the silos and the barriers. And I think that's why we're seeing such growth in the chief revenue officer. You know, whatever you want to call it, they're putting the remit of sales marketing coming under one roof. LinkedIn at the start of this year have seen a 60-70% increase in Australia in chief revenue officer roles. And I personally, like my personal stance is, I think it's a good thing, because you can't have the divorced couple anymore in the age of digital sales.
That's right. And yet, why is it that some organizations are holding on to 2010 or 1995 and having it all separate? Because you said before that sometimes you're bringing groups together and they're literally saying to you, this is the first time we've done that. And you must be sitting there thinking, what are you for real? What is going on? It's just because it's so logical. Because you think if we're a customer-centric organization and we're an organization that wants to provide value to the marketplace, doesn't it just make common sense, which is also not common, that we align ourselves to be customer facing, irrespective of who is speaking to the customer, the message becomes exactly the same. And we know what the
And
customer looks like.
I do relate to it. When I was a sales leader at IBM, 100% I was guilty of this. 100% was I in tune with marketing? Probably not. Was I probably doing the polar opposite? Yeah, probably. And so I 100% understand where the problem comes from, and I think I've been guilty of being part of the problem. So I'll own that. But I think now, having been the other side of the fence and seeing it, I can absolutely 100% see why there's the divide, but also how to repair that divide. The growth that comes from it is unbelievable. So honestly, my takeaway for your listeners would be, get your sales, get your marketing in a room, have a huddle, with that intention, like you said, around what are we seeing, what are clients talking about, what are the problems. It changes the game.
And get out of your own way, because from experience, there are some sales people that I had the I guess the privilege of working with who were very old school, who didn't want to change. And maybe it was because, I don't know, fear of maybe imposter syndrome or fear of, I don't know, their role changing, whatever the case might be. They were just hanging on for dear life to the old way of doing things. Now, if we're going to be successful in 2024 and beyond, we have to adapt, we have to change, we have to be flexible. We have to be curious in terms of what does the market need from us today and in the next 3 months, and how do we best serve that marketplace to put ourselves in the best position to be successful. So we have to adapt.
I really agree with you. I wrote an article on this on LinkedIn yesterday, and I think you've hit the nail on the head, but I think this is one of the other, top three challenges is we are having to adapt to a really increased speed of change and suddenly go, okay, as a seller, how do I leverage AI? And even for me, like I myself confess, turbo geek, learning geek, I, will read every day, I will go on every course that I can get my hands on, like I love it. But I'm even struggling to keep up with the pace of change that someone's talking about some new sales intelligence tool that's the, solving world peace. And I'm like, what is it? I haven't heard of it. God, I've got to go research it, right? And getting FOMO. But so I do understand that. But I think that we have to, I think that's another skill. Again, I talked to you before, we've done a piece of work recently around what are some of the skills we think people need to have. The number one thing we came up with was starting with exactly what you said, which is how do we encourage people to actually embrace change? Because as humans, we're not designed to like change. We don't like change. And so how do we help people on that journey? And I think that that's where we have to check. Evolve with it, but also evolve with the changing remit of that. Even if you think about LinkedIn as one topic, just one of the many, historically that was marketing's problem. And now I think it's actually everybody has a role to play on that. And so I think we have to change that. And I've got people in my network, and I'm sure you're the same. Ask them to present to a CIO or a CEO. They'll do it with absolute confidence. They've been doing it for 25 years and they're off and they're on their way. Ask them to post on LinkedIn, and it's like, oh, I don't want to sound like an ass. I hope I can say that. I don't want to sound like, ugh, like I don't want to sound full of myself. I don't want to put myself out there. And I get that. I relate to that immensely. But there's a skill and a muscle that we need to learn and we need to develop. So I think ability to change and adapt. I feel we're almost in that state without sounding overly dramatic of evolve or die. And how are we helping sales teams on that journey?
Because the evolution of the salesperson is continuing to change. And I reckon with AI having more and more of an influence over how we do things, that's just going to change even quicker. So it's the ones that can pivot, that can take on as an opportunity to learn new stuff, break into new frontiers, go even further on the hero's journey and jump into the new world. And it's just embrace the uncertainty that might create, but know that you can handle it. Because at the end of the day, as you've alluded to, at the core of what we do, take out all the technology and all the enablement tools, at the end of the day, people like doing business with those who they know, who they like, and who they trust. And that's never actually going to change. Because if you don't trust somebody, if you don't like somebody, there's no way you're going to do business with them. It's just as simple as that, irrespective of how good their product is. So that's the fundamental core thing to never forget, I guess, as well. So, hey, this has been a phenomenal conversation. Really enjoyed this. If there was one parting message that you'd like to leave people listening to this, whether they be a salesperson in a small organization, mid organization, or a big behemoth, or a sales leader, that they're thinking and looking forward to 2024, what's one lasting piece of advice or guidance, piece of inspiration, if you like, that you like to leave them with they can hold on to and use as a bit of a catalyst for moving forward?
Oh, that's so hard to pinpoint it down to one. I think I'm gonna have to. It's so unfair. It's like when someone asks me my favorite book, I'm like, it's almost like you're asking your favorite child. Don't ask me that. I think that it's probably embrace continuous learning. And the reason I say that is exactly what we just talked about. You know, the market is evolving quickly. There is AI coming in. There is the buyer profile has changed. All those different things, everything we've talked about in this conversation. And I think the only way you can embrace that, the only way you can keep up with that, the only reason you can make the most of it and help use it to hit your number and overachieve and to grow is actually by always being curious and continuously learning. I think, you know, I read the other day in a book, like, the learning never ends. And even though that's such a simple thing that I've probably read 1,000 times, it just really stuck in my mind because it's like, it is true. Like, I get it, but I think that we've just got to keep learning. Otherwise, we're not going to evolve and we are going to get left behind. I don't think we can sit here and go, well, I've had a successful career and this is the way it's always been done. I think we've got to challenge ourselves to get uncomfortable.
100%. And I fully agree. Because the ones that don't continue to learn are the ones that will be perish. They'll perish. And that's not literally, but they'll become less and less relevant in their marketplace. Love this conversation, Abby. For the people listening that would like to connect with you first and foremost and learn more about what you do in terms of your marriage counselor work in sales and marketing, learning more about Sales Redefined, where's the best place for them to connect with you and learn more about what you do?
Yeah, definitely don't come for your actual marriage counseling, just the sales and marketing marriage counseling. So on LinkedIn, I'm always hanging out on LinkedIn. So Abby White, and our business is salesredefined.com.au. So feel free to connect with us on either of those platforms, and we would love to connect.
Brilliant. Absolutely love it. So I'll put those in the show notes. Absolute pleasure. I know you've got another meeting to get to, so I greatly appreciate you taking some time on this beautiful Thursday to chat all things sales redefining style. So Abby, thanks very much for being on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.
Awesome. Enjoy the rest of your day. Thank you for listening to the Exceptional Sales Leader Podcast. I trust the information in this episode has been helpful in your journey towards becoming exceptional. And remember, please take the time to rate the show, subscribe to the show so other people can find it. But also, if I can help you, jump on my calendar, go to leadwithdarren.com, and let's have a conversation about how I can help you along your journey to being exceptional.